Kenneth Moore describes the great upheaval on both sides of the Atlantic, which followed the sensational success of Irving Berlin with Alexander's ragtime band. He also examines the bitter controversies raised by the first ever Royal Command performance, and follows the English-speaking world as it sang and danced its way towards the abyss of the Great War.
Today, when we look back on the years from 1908 to 1914, we see a world racing towards death and destruction. But the Edwardians themselves seem to have no suspicion of what was waiting for them in the wings of history, in Flanders, Jutland, and the Dardanelles. Or if they did suspect, they hid their feelings very well. And yet, surely they had an idea at odd moments that the ground was beginning to shift from under them? Otherwise, why recite lyrics like this one, which was the hit of the 1911 edition of the Policier Follies?
There'll be no war, as long as we've a king like good King Edward, there'll be no war. He hates that kind of thing. Mothers, don't worry, as long as we've a king like good King Edward, peace with honour is our motto. God save the king. Dum dum pom pom pom.
There'll be no war, as long as we've got good King Edward. The irony is that the king died in the very year that song became popular, in 1911. But for the moment, popular music, and indeed the masses who made it popular, proceeded on their way in a peaceful world. In America, the moon was already acknowledged not just as a rhyme for June, but as a firm basis for commercial success. In 1909, a songwriter called Gus Edwards hit the jackpot, and a contemporary of his, the composer A. Bowman, remembers how Edwards did it.
He was the romantic songwriter of that particular era. And I remember about two nights a week, we would go out and cover some of the cafes. We would start at 42nd and Broadway, the Café de l'Opéra. And one of the songs that he would use first, I would be at the piano, and he would come from the rear of the restaurant with a little mask on, with a flashlight, with his, one of his great songs, Look Out. Look out, look out for Jimmy Valentine, and come up on the stage, you know. And he was a beautiful singer, and he could expose himself beautifully with the song when he got into the By the Lights of the Silvery Moon and so forth.
By the lights of the silvery moon, I want a spoon. Honey, I'll croon love's tune.
Honeymoon, keep a shining in June.
Your silvery beams will bring our dreams. We'll be cuddling soon by the silvery moon.
Place.
Sound of kisses floating on the breeze.
Act one, begun. Dialogue, where would you like to spoon?
My cue, with you underneath the silvery moon.
By the light of the silvery moon, I want to spoon.
Years after By the Light of the Silvery Moon in 1912, moonshine became big business in Tin Pan Alley for the second time, when a team called Madden and Wenrick came up with the perfect vehicle for crying into your beer, a song that became a favorite with the family of the American president, Woodrow Wilson.
We were sailing along.
Passion for lunar sentiments like that had really been established a little earlier than either Moonlight Bay or By the Light of the Silvery Moon in 1908, which brings us to one of the most amazing figures in the history of show business, Florence Ziegfeld, or Flo to his friends, and there weren't too many of those. He had an embarrassing habit of forgetting to pay his writers their fees, and P.G. Wodehouse, who knew Ziegfeld well, once said of him, "You feel that $100 bills mean no more to him than paper matches to a cigar store, and half the time he hasn't enough to buy a knitted waistcoat for a smallish gnat." Well, even without the knitted waistcoats, Ziegfeld managed to put on some of the most memorable shows in the annals of entertainment, and in 1908, he staged this one.
One night was mighty dark, so you could hardly see, for the moon refused to shine. Couple sitting underneath a willow tree, for love they pine. The little maid was kind of afraid of darkness, so she said, "I guess I'll go." Boy began to sigh, looked up at the sky, for the moon is little terrible.
The name of the show that that song came from was The Follies, and they were follies in more ways than one. In 1908, there was a scene with chorus girls in a swimming pool, and one night somebody threw Ziegfeld into it. In 1910, the leading lady was fired out of a rocket, and a couple of follies later, a rival Casanova tried to kick Ziegfeld to death outside the stage door of his own theatre. But the follies were a clever idea. Ziegfeld, after all, wanted to hide the fact that he was putting on the same musical review every year, and he did that by calling his shows by the name of the year. Abe Ullman has never forgotten the lavish nature of Ziegfeld's production style.
The costumes in the Follies, they were absolutely superlative. I don't think anything today can bypass the Ziegfeld Follies costumes. The others were all right, but the shows themselves were not on such a tremendous exploitation of money and so forth to dress the show. Going back to some of the current productions, like Babes in the Woods and Sonny, and they were nice. The performers were beautiful and very accomplished. And you really didn't look for anything that was tremendous in costume. They were dressed neatly anyway. But the Follies, that was something else. And even today, they can't surpass it.
And before we leave the great Ziegfeld, as he liked to think of himself, a peep even further forward to make the point that his influence over popular music still hasn't quite died away. Because one of the hundreds of songs written for him or commissioned by him was this one.
They call me Jack in the Road. Even a piano in the bar.
Bryce singing one of the songs that Ziegfeld presented in The Follies. Listening to that song raises one vital question. What is it that's different about tunes like Secondhand Rose that divides them so utterly from the music we've been listening to so far? The difference is the great upheaval, revolution, call it what you like, that hit popular music in 1911. It was the most violent and widespread change in popular musical patterns ever to take place in our century. And it announced itself in these strains.
Oh, my honey, you better hurry and let's go down there. Ain't you going to that little man, ragged little man. Oh, honey, let me take you to Alexander, grandstand, grandstand. Ain't you coming along, come on in here. Come on in here, Alexander the Ragtime Band. Come on in here, come on in here. It's the best band in the land. They can play the bugle call like you never heard before. Sounds so natural that you want to go to war. That's just the best band in the land. Oh, honey lamb, come on along, come on along. Let me take you by the hand. Up to the man. Up to the man who is the leader of the band. And if you hear the yell of the Warning River, played in ragtime, come on in here, come on in here, Alexander's Ragtime Band.
Alexander's Ragtime Band, sung there by the Empress of the Blues, the great Bessie Smith, thrust its composer Irving Berlin into the history books overnight. It wasn't the first song Berlin had written. It wasn't even his first hit, but it was his first world-shattering hit. Berlin was a Russian-born son of starving immigrants on New York's East Side, who graduated from singing waiter to song plugger to songwriter. And Alexander's Ragtime Band was the song he wrote which at one stroke put all other kinds of popular music from George M. Cohan to the Merry Widow right into the past. Whether his song actually had anything to do with ragtime is another question. Probably the answer is no, and even Irving Berlin half agrees.
Everyone thinks that Alexander's Ragtime Band, which was written in 1911, started ragtime. It did not. Ragtime was written years before I even thought of the phrase. But it did crystallize it. I mean, it sort of made a thing out of ragtime at that particular time. And I wrote several after that myself.
All right. Let's take Irving Berlin at his word and compare his ragtime with the real thing. Here's ragtime, Berlin style.
Come
from Berlin's Alexander Ragtime Band to the music of the great ragtime pioneer, Scott Joplin. Leaf Rag, one of the later compositions by Scott Joplin, circa 1908. So, it seems that Irving Berlin was popularizing the word ragtime rather than its sound. But whatever it was he was popularizing, it became a world sensation in double-quick time. Within a couple of years, for instance, of Alexander's ragtime band hitting America, it was hitting London too, and was making its influence felt at the time of one of the most famous and controversial incidents in British musical history. But before we come to that event, perhaps we should stop a while and ask ourselves what songwriters lived on in the palmy days of Edwardian plenty. One of the most influential composers of light music of this period was Victor Herbert, who several times found himself reduced to the tactics of laying siege to Flo Ziegfeld in Ziegfeld's outer office in an attempt to collect overdue royalties. And it was Herbert who, quite by accident, became involved in the incident that did more to raise the status of the songwriter in America than any other single event. Composer-producer Arthur Schwartz gives the details of a story never before told in this country.
Puccini came to America. He was writing The Girl of the Golden West, an opera based on an American story, even though he was an Italian composer. And his publisher was called George Maxwell, who was also the publisher for Victor Herbert. Puccini and Victor Herbert and George Maxwell went one night to a restaurant called Shanley's. They listened to a whole series of Victor Herbert songs being played and sung in this restaurant. And Puccini said, "Don't you get paid for the performance of these things, Mr. Herbert?" And he said, "No, no, we haven't got anything like that that protects us." He said, "Well, you should do that." So they got their lawyer, whose name was Nathan Burkan, and he started a lawsuit which went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court Justice, Oliver Wendell Holmes, a famous man, wrote the opinion which gave birth to ASCAP. ASCAP stands for the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. And that is the society which collects the music royalties for the performance of music everywhere in America. And also it pays English composers for works that of theirs that are played in America, as the English Society, PRS, pays us for American songs played here. But that's the way it started, with a lawsuit to get the highest court in the land to say that these rights have to be protected.
Well, Arthur Schwartz is not the only composer to remember Victor Herbert with affection. Herbert's ballad writing, half American, half European, was immensely influential in guiding the tastes of rising young men, or even schoolboys, as Richard Rogers was once upon a time.
I know that the first musical show I saw was the Pied Piper of Hamelin with DeWolf Hopper. That didn't impress me as much as one I saw a few years later called Little Nemo. It had a score by Victor Herbert, and a very lovely score it was, too. And there was tremendous excitement for weeks and weeks before I was taken to the matinee. And I remember that it was at the New Amsterdam Theater. And I remember that we sat in a left-hand upper box. Whole family went. My brother went, too.
Like an eternal serenade, while you're
While Richard Rogers was growing up in the giant shadow of Victor Herbert, and Irving Berlin was unleashing a Baudelaireized version of ragtime on the world, the British musical scene seemed to be as self-contained as ever. Apart from the music hall, music in England still reflected those class divisions that Sir Neville Cardus has described. For instance, in 1912, all London is supposed to have danced to the strains of a particularly seductive waltz. But what was all London? A handful of the best families? A group of plutocrats? The middle classes? Well, we don't know. What we do know is that many years later, after the bloodbath of Flanders, more than one social historian nominated this melody as a symbol of the old days that had mysteriously vanished forever. The year is 1912, and while you sit in a conservatory, admiring your hostess's bare shoulders, or sprawl in the billiard room's leather upholstery having a quiet smoke, you hear in the distance. Perhaps destiny is a bit too saccharine for your tastes, in which case you might become a patron of the new cultural sensation, the ballet. The Russian dancers first arrived in Britain in 1911, and in no time the name Pavlova was synonymous with weightless grace and beauty. Sir Neville Cardus's recollection is typical of the romance with which all the eyewitnesses of Anna Pavlova seem to remember her.
Only once when Pavlova came to the Free Trade Hall, Manchester. We had no scenery, just a black curtain, and she had a core, a ballet core there. And on the platform was a loose plank. And when the rest of the ballet danced, you heard this plank go plump. But when she danced, not a sound.
Thank you.
1912, Diaghilev and Nijinsky were famous names in Britain. And one historian has written that music hall gallery goers fell in love with the Russian ballet. And it was clear to all that something dramatic had happened to ballet music. All those tutus, all those suburban maidens tripping through interminable versions of Les Sylphides were giving way to something very different. And if Stravinsky had happened to the ballet, ragtime had happened to music hall. As Europe drifted lazily towards war, ragtime, the new factor in the popular music equation, began to take hold. Worshippers of Terpsichore, who had mastered the waltz, suddenly found themselves confronted by what sounded like a menagerie, the bunny hug, the chicken scramble, and so on. One of the young folk who found it all a bit hard to take was J.B. Priestley.
Of all the new exciting things that were crowding into our lives, the most urgent hit me when I went over to Leeds to a variety show at the Empire and heard ragtime. Suddenly, I discovered the 20th century glaring and screaming at me.
Oh, I forget the everything. It's the cutest little thing.
The syncopated frenzy of this was something quite new. Shining with sweat, the ragtimers almost hung over the footlights, defying us to resist the rhythm and drumming us into another kind of life in which anything might happen.
And if ragtime represented the invasion of North America, there was another, very different sort of dance that suddenly arrived from South America. And South America, being the fiery place it was, it's not surprising that not only the dancing, but also the dancers could sometimes get a bit too passionate, as Stanley Holloway demonstrates.
Well, it had a tango tease. And it was just a phase. It did business by encouraging people to go out and to tea, which, of course, the women loved. And it was built up then, during the war especially, tango tees, all jerky stuff, you know, and then going down the... El Choclo, it's called. And, of course, Fred Emney, he was a pianist, and he was abroad, and he was playing in some night joint somewhere in Mexico, I think it was. And it was getting late on, and he was tired. He was sitting, and in came the bewhiskered fellows, you know, with extraordinary clothes on, and he walked up to Fred. He said, "Play El Choclo." So Fred, did you go in yourself to see? He said he took out a revolver and fired three shots into the piano. Fred said, "I played El Choclo till dawn."
In time, both the tango and ragtime settled in to become part of the conventional pattern of popular music. But while tango has always remained a small, specialized department of dancing, where each performer sees how close he can get to splintering his partner's shin without actually doing it, ragtime changed the face of popular music once and for all. Earlier, when Irving Berlin told how he followed Alexander's ragtime band with other ragtime pieces, he certainly had in mind an item from 1912 called Everybody's Doing It, which opened its European career in a review at the Old Empire Theatre on February the 14th, 1912.
Everybody's doing it.
Everybody's Doing It brings us finally to that great contretemps of 1912, the first Royal Command performance. Now, if you look down the program of that prestigious event, you'll find that Everybody's Doing It was among the items to be performed before their Majesties, but that it was withdrawn at the last minute. The reasons are buried in history a long time ago, but in any case, the whole of Britain was preoccupied by a far more interesting issue concerning the royal performance. Randolph Sutton describes the issue at stake.
Musical has always been regarded as a working-class entertainment by some people, but it got a big boost on 1st of July, 1912, when the first Royal Command performance took place at the Palace Theatre. All the big stars of music hall appeared, with one very notable exception, one of the greatest music hall stars ever, Miss Murray Lloyd. Because of this royal patronage, the old music hall had suddenly become respectable, and the organizers thought that Mara's broad, honest vulgarity might lower the tone of it. Everybody wanted to do a rival show on the same night called The People's Command, with Mari topping the bill, but she wouldn't do it. She said, "Every performance by Mari Lloyd is by command of the British public."
Well, who left Mari out of it? One of her biographers suggests it must have been some obscure court official worried in case Mari's calculated vulgarity might displease a crowned head or two. Then again, one of the members of the committee which selected the artists for the show was our old friend Sir Oswald Stoll. And it's just possible he might have been thinking of the music hall strike of a few years earlier when he and Mari were virtual leaders of the opposing forces. Still, we'll never know. The important thing was that the show went ahead without Mari, and judging from the evidence, it was an immensely spectacular, widely reported, and very dull affair. Not that all the artists weren't highly accomplished. One of them was a great droll of the period, a man whose technique was later recalled in vivid detail by Sir Neville Cardus.
There was the empty stage. Wilkie Bard, as a charwoman, comes down the stage with a pail of water, with a dishcloth, got down on his knees, made a great circle of wetness, which was a sphere of operations, to clean the floor, and then wrung out the dishcloth, and then walked down the stage and leaned over the footlights and began, "I want to sing in opera. I want to sing in opera.
I'm getting so tired of these comedy songs. I want to sing something divine. I'm sure and I'm certain to shine as a star in the opera line. I simply love Wagner, Mozart, and Puccini. Their music is really tip-top. So I'm going to change my name Block to Blogini and see if I can't get a shot. I want to sing in opera. I've got that kind of voice. I'd always sing in opera if I could have my choice. Signor Caruso told me I ought to do so. That's why I want to sing in opera, sing in opera, opera. I want to sing in opera. I've got that kind of voice. I'd always sing in opera if I could have my choice. Signor Caruso told me I ought to do so. That's why I want to sing in opera, sing in opera, opera, opera."
Who else besides Wilkie Bard appeared at that concert on July 1st, 1912? Well, there was George Robey, for one, and he recalls yet another artist who was invited to perform that night.
The scene of the miracle was the Palace Theatre. On the night, it looked marvellous. It was decorated with about 3 million roses. Now, some of my normally boisterous colleagues were perhaps a little overwhelmed by the solemnity of the occasion, not to mention having suffered at the hands of the censor, who went through our rehearsal with a fine comb. Nevertheless, the affair passed off splendidly. The palace girls danced charmingly. I watched them from the side of the stage. Yes. And they actually dared to wear knee-length skirts. I was surprised. David Davant conjured with rabbits and eggs from all sorts of places, and Harry Lauder went roaming through the gloaming.
I've seen lots of bunny laddies on my travels wide, but my heart is centre new on bunny Kate McBride. Although I am no a fella that would throw a word away, I'm surprised sometimes myself at all I've got to say. Roaming in the gloaming on the bonny banks of Clyde, roaming in the gloaming with my laddie by my side. When the sun has gone to rest, that's the time that we love best. Oh, it's lovely roaming in the gloaming, roaming in the gloaming on the bonny banks of Clyde. The sun has gone for rest. That's the time that we love
best. Oh, it's lovely, roaming in the gloaming. Apart from Harry Lauder, George Robey also sang in that show.
Just been elected as mayor of the old-fashioned Calmuck and Dyke, where half of the folks do no work and the other half do as they like. I've had great distrust on the square, for they simply thrust me in the chair. Then they place this gold chain round my neck, saying, "Hail to thee, Muck and Dyke's mayor." Turn again, Muck and Dyke's mayor. Stickleback, pride of the chair. Everybody can do as they like. Now Stickleback's mayor of Muck and Dyke.
Just to see exactly what it was about Marie Lloyd's repertoire that made it so different from that sort of thing, it might be useful to listen not to Marie, but her daughter, Marie Lloyd Jr., who, many years later, gave an impressive impersonation of her more famous mother, singing precisely the sort of song that caused so many Edwardian lips to tut-tut in disapproval. I must admit, it all sounds perfectly acceptable today. But the point that Stanley Holloway makes is that what's acceptable today was by no means acceptable yesterday.
They thought her songs were risque, which may have been at that time. It's difficult to view it now in retrospect because it doesn't seem it. But I think it was in that time. The thing was that the vulgarity of that time were concerned with powdering the baby's bottom or something like that, you see, which was ordinary, honest-to-God vulgarity. But I suppose they thought she wasn't probably quite dependable to put on the right songs. I don't know. But it was a bit cathedral-like in those days, I suppose.
And ruins I like to scan. Yet say I'm fond of ruins, whoop, if you saw my old man. I went out in the country for a stroll the other day, cause I like to study history and pubs along the way. I came across an abbey that was tumbled all to bits. It seemed a relic of a bygone day. A gentleman says, "What is this?" I says, "Excuse me, sir, I'll tell you all about it if I may. It's a bit of a ruin, the Cromwell knocked about a bit. Oh, one of the ruins, the Cromwell knocked about a bit. In the day, old days, ooh, there used to be some doings. No wonder that the poor old Abbey went to ruin. The is tracing and chart of it. And you can bet your life there isn't a doubt of it. Cause outside the Cromwell Arms last Saturday night, I was one of the ruins that called one up about a bit.
The world represented by that sort of song was very soon to disappear in the smoke of the Great War. But for the moment, the music hall continued to thrive, and Randolph Sutton recalls its vintage days.
The old Metropolitan Theatre in Edgware Road, the Met was real music hall, from 1897 until it was pulled down in 1963. There, you could have a nice glass of beer and watch the turn through the windows of the stalled spa. And 70 years before it was pulled down, great performers like dear old Harry Champion used to bring the house down every night.
I was in it for only 6 months, oh, my mother and my father too. They didn't know what to wean me on, but in the dreadful stew. They thought of this, they thought of that, or a little bit of oak I'd row. I said, pop round to the old cook shop and I'll tell you what'll make me grow. Boiled beef and carriage, boiled beef and carriage. That's the stuff for your dorby kelp. Makes you fat and it keeps you well done, live like vegetarian. Food they give to Paris, from all day night, blow out your kind of boiled beef and carriage. Boiled beef and carriage, boiled beef and carriage. Got a lodger, he's an artful cove, I'm very, very queer, he said. We sent for the doctor, he came out, told him to jump in bed. The poor chap said, I do feel bad. Mother, with a tear, replied, said, what would you like for a pick-me-up? He jumped out of bed and cried.